This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We human beings spend an awful lot of time and energy pursuing our primal urges and relatively little talking about or studying them. Well, that's about to change. Our guest, scientist-turned-science journalist Zoe Cormier's first book is a collection of surprising and amazing facts about the biology and neurochemistry of hedonism. It's called Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. And as debauched as the title is, the quest to satisfy these base instincts have led humans to groundbreaking discoveries. Without LSD, for example, we might not know how to unravel DNA or understand the brain chemistry of certain mental disorders. A note here that despite making her case for the redemptive power of these reprobate topics, Zoe and I will be talking about some body parts and things that could make some people squeamish or might be unsuitable for children. And with that, Zoe Cormier, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
Humans chase after sexual pleasure, narcotics of many stripes, and music across all cultures. We're united in this. Does hedonism make us human?
It's part of what makes us human. So normally when scientists and philosophers think about what is it that demarcates us from the rest of the animal kingdom, they tend to focus on our higher cognitive capacities, such as the ability to do mathematics, the capacity for language, the ability to think about the past, present, and future, all of these things that we think of as higher functions of our consciousness. In fact, in our name, Homo sapiens, that means the Latin for wise man. And so taking drugs and engaging in sexual activity and making music have tended to be denigrated as primitive or basic because all other animals do reproduce and indulge in narcotic plants and make noise. But if you take a closer look at these three activities, you find that we actually have taken all of them to the next level, and they are integral to what defines our species just as much as the capacity to think about the past or to be able to write things down.
Human bodies are built for gaining pleasure from sex. That's one of the things revealed in your book. So what are some of the biological and neurological characteristics that make that true? Let's start with women.
For one, breasts are unique in the animal kingdom, in fact. Only humans have swollen glands like these that are swollen all the time, whereas if you look at other primates, for example, they have similar tissue, but it only swells when they're breastfeeding. And then other animals, such as cows, they have sort of like a big bag of milk. Ours are completely distinct, and that's quite significant. They think that it could serve as a visual attractor. And certainly... Can I use the... I'm not sure
the word that rhymes with Dolores.
Yes, the word that rhymes with Dolores. I'm very happy to talk about the clitoris. The clitoris is the only part of the human anatomy that is designed for pleasure alone and only pleasure. And it appears to be the only organ in all of the animal kingdom, although, you know, you'd have to know what it feels like to be a sea slug to know if this is true. But it seems to be the only biological body part that is built for pleasure alone.
How about for men? What distinguishes the male sex organ, especially from other mammals? We are the only species in which a man has a bone in his sex organ, which means what? That the brain has to be involved?
Exactly. So almost all other mammals have bones in their penises. So dogs, cats, and even our closest relatives, chimpanzees, have bones in their penises. So the fact that other factors are required to get it up and to keep it up means that other issues are more important, such as what goes on in the brain, and that clearly arousal in the mind is a really important facet of our biology.
This also points to one of the themes in the book, that scientific research reveals something about our base instinct. Like in this case, you point out that Viagra was actually first tested as a treatment for jet lag. What happened with that testing process?
So the jet lag cure, Viagra, was originally tested for altitude sickness because what it does is it acts on the blood vessels and it prevents blood from escaping your veins and your arteries. And so your blood vessels have a lot to do with why you feel sick after you've flown, because you've gone up in the air and come down. And Viagra happened to have this interesting side effect. And when the scientists who were researching it wanted to halt the trial, the men involved in the trial very largely said, "Oh, better not, please." And the rest is history.
Well, this is similarly, LSD was developed as a tool for preventing excessive bleeding. And in turn,
yes,
the use of LSD led to Watson and Crick discerning the structure for DNA. Tell us that story.
So Albert Hofmann, who created LSD, we like to think of most people who come up with narcotics as being weirdos and, you know, in their sheds, messing around with chemicals, such as Alexander Shulgin. But Hofmann was a nerd. He was a Swiss nerd, and he spent his entire career working for Sandoz in the mountains of Switzerland. And prior to coming up with LSD, he spent 10 years working on treatments to prevent death by postpartum hemorrhaging. And in fact, he created something called methergine, which is still one of the most widely used drugs in obstetrics. He spent most of his career trying to save the lives of pregnant women. And then one day he had this chemical that he had made, LSD-25, and something about that molecule, it had sat on a laboratory shelf for about 5 years since he first synthesized it. Something about it drew him back to it, and he went and he brought out the solution, and he got a bit on his fingers, and the rest is history. Leading on from this, we're not entirely sure if Watson and Crick discovered the shape of DNA, because it was just a rumor, but they were known to be party animals, and there was a journalist who said that Crick had told him that he had gotten his insight into the structure of DNA while on LSD, but we'll never really know. We do know that a guy named Cary Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for coming up with something called the polymerase chain reaction, which is basically a method of reading DNA, we know that he got his incredible insight into how DNA could be read while on LSD, because he wrote about it in his autobiography.
As a co-founder of Guerrilla Science, Zoe Cormier has helped create live events and installations that connect people to the wonders of science. Well, we're talking with her about her book, Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. It's a collection of surprising and revealing research into the biology and neurochemistry of the human pursuit of pleasure and checking out and rocking out. No, of course, Zoe Cormier, we can understand the biological urge to mate, but human beings experimenting with mind alteration and transcendence, they've been doing this for thousands of years. So something else is at play. What are they looking for?
Ooh, what are they looking for? People who experiment. That's a very good question, and that's not necessarily something I can answer from a scientific perspective, but I guess just anecdotally, when, you know, you talk to people about why they would do these things. I would say that narcotic use is one of the most puzzling facets of human biology, and it's incredibly pervasive, and certainly when you see the bad side of chemical addiction and reliance and misuse, it's absolutely heartbreaking. So what is it that draws us to do these things? Some psychiatrists who work with drugs call them medicaments for the human condition, which I think is a good way of putting it. So when you talk about things like opiates and painkillers or caffeine or alcohol to alleviate stress, that kind of makes more sense when you think about it that way.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned addiction, which is, of course, such a serious problem. But we do know that many people suffering from mental illness do mask their symptoms with drugs or reach for drugs. They're trying to get something, a particular kind of neurotransmitter. They're looking for a different feeling. What is that connection between what we know about mind-altering drugs and brain science?
One of the most interesting things that I uncovered in my research was the ways that drugs led to the discovery of neurotransmitters. So neurotransmitters are the chemical messengers in the mind that the body uses for neurons to talk to each other. And so you can think of them like chemical packages that are chucked between cells, like cargo between two ships. And so on the receiving cell, you have a receptor that is built for that particular neurotransmitter, like a lock and key. So basically, the question in the 19th century, as the neuroscience and the chemistry and the understanding of drugs was starting to flourish, the question was, how can a chemical made by a plant, such as opium made by poppy, caffeine made by tea, how can these chemicals create an effect within the human body? What is the mechanism by which that would work? And the ways that drugs work is they mimic our neurotransmitters. So the chemicals in opium mimic what are called our endorphins. The chemicals in cannabis mimic what are called the endocannabinoids. But we understood the structure of the drugs many years before we understood the structure of the neurotransmitter. So the first time this happened was with nicotine. And they mapped the structure of nicotine in the 1800s, and they tracked down the neurotransmitter that it mimics in the 1960s, and they called it the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. We named our own body part after nicotine.
A drug.
After a drug.
Where there are drugs altering the brain, music is not far behind. And music and drugs, it turns out, both tickle some of the same neural networks. So are humans wired for music as well?
Absolutely. We're wired from birth for music. In fact, every single person in the world is born with perfect pitch.
Really? Although you point out that a number of people, as much as 4% of the population, suffer from amusia, which means they can't hear music at all. So it's all just noise. Why would that be?
It's because it requires every part of your brain working in concert together to create the sensation of music. And if any one of those bits of the brain isn't necessarily working in exactly the same fashion as it does in the general population, you can have a slight breakdown in your ability to comprehend music the way that other people do. But there are many different kinds of amusia. There's about a dozen forms that have been identified. Not everybody who has amusia dislikes music entirely. Some people still enjoy rhythm, for example, even if they can't perceive timbre and pitch. But people who have amusia, they don't tend to realize that they're different to everybody else because it's not like color blindness, for example. It's not something that you can as easily test for. And they mostly just tend to be a bit bemused or confused by why everybody else likes these weird sounds. And it was really only in the past 20 years that scientists, particularly working at McGill in Montreal, started to get a good understanding of how common this is.
Well, there's much evidence that we have of musicians creating under the influence. Billie Holiday, the Beatles, the Grateful Dead, Miles Davis, David Bowie, Aphex Twins. But there's been very little real scientific study of the role that drugs may play in musical experimentation. And why is that?
Practically speaking, it's not really going to get you any funding. If you want to get funding to look at, say, treatments using marijuana to treat multiple sclerosis, that's much more likely to appeal to an eagle-eyed funder than asking for money to smoke pot and listen to Bob Marley and to see what happens to your brain. But that being said, they did very recently in England, in fact, Channel 4 paid for an analysis of what happens in the minds of people who are smoking cannabis and their desire to listen to music. And they found that the desire to listen to music increases rapidly. And it has a lot to do with something called what's called the salience network. But it's interesting that this study was undertaken at the behest of a television station and not a university, because, well, they're more likely to have more freedom with their cash, aren't they?
Well, sex and drugs and rock and roll were put together for a reason by Ian Dury and the Blockheads from the song "Is All My Brain and Body Needs," if I remember. And in your book, what is it that we can learn about being human from studying them, Zoe Cormier?
First of all, these are not aspects of the human condition that we should try to repress because we think they're sinful. These are aspects of our condition that are universal and are genuinely important to the way our species is the way it is. That doesn't mean we should spend all day sitting around getting high and listening to music, but it means that doing so now and then can be a meaningful experience. I think it's quite funny. I researched for this book for 3 years, and my mother summed up 3 years of scientific research in one sentence. "Most fun things in life are bad for you, but nothing will kill you faster than having no fun at all."
Zoe Cormier, journalist, photographer, science writer, co-founder of Guerrilla Science, and now author of Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, The Science of Hedonism and the Hedonism of Science. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, how hell has evolved from flaming torture chamber to the horrors of the real world. Stick around for that story when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
One, two.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
Your mind lies in the devil's workshop.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is Holy Thursday on the Christian calendar. In accordance with biblical gospels, it is a day to commemorate the Last Supper Jesus shared with his apostles before crucifixion. For the faithful, Jesus' suffering, death, and resurrection provide a path to atonement and salvation for humanity. As the theology evolved, so did the notion of being saved as an escape from the fiery furnaces of hell. Today, hell is a long commute, other people a scary threat to behave, an expletive or a metaphor that many contemporary theologians do not even believe exists. Candida Moss is a professor of theology at Notre Dame University. She pondered the nature of hell for the Daily Beast. And Dr. Candida Moss, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
When does this notion of hell first appear in history?
Well, hell develops very gradually. So originally when people died, they were buried in the ground. And so that space under the ground was sort of this shadowy realm. But it was a place that everyone went to. It wasn't specifically bad people. But over time, and in about the 2nd century BC, under influence from emerging Babylonian traditions and the ancient Greeks, people began to think of Hades as a bad place, a place with fire, a place of torment and punishment for the wicked. And over the course of the next 2,000 years, the details of those tortures and those punishments got really excruciating, and hell just got sort of bigger and more detailed.
How about for the other religions of the book, for the Hebrew Bible, for example, or for Islam? Are there notions of heaven and hell?
Yeah, there are definitely notions of heaven and hell in both Judaism and in Islam. What's interesting is that in Judaism, the reason why people began to think about eternal torment was because they were oppressed by foreign regimes. And initially they thought, if we're good, God will vindicate us and free us from the Greeks who were oppressing us. And when that didn't happen, they began to put the idea of reward and punishment further in the future. So at some point in the distant future, the world will end, and then there'll be a final sorting period, and the good people will go to heaven and the bad people will go to hell. And that notion of hell was actually really important. It was important that the bad people who mistreated you now would one day see that they were wrong, and they would see that you were right, and they would be punished for the bad things they had done to you.
How about in Islam? We, of course, have the image of paradise. How about hell?
Yeah, there are notions of torment and punishment in Islam as well. There's a lot of exchange between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, particularly in the 6th through 10th centuries. And Islam flourished in a region that had been really influenced by Babylonian traditions and Zoroastrianism, which was also very keen on hell. And a lot of those traditions came into Islam as well.
Let's go back then to the early Christians, where hell becomes a place where those deserving punishment go and suffer eternal torment. When did the eternal torment idea come into it?
Well, you can see it sort of in nuggets in the New Testament. So in the book of Revelation, there's a lake of fire into which death and Satan and the sinners are thrown. And it's unclear if that's forever or if you sort of get consumed in the fire and then that's it for you. But in the centuries following, Christians began to develop sort of tours of hell where they would talk about what happens to adulterers or what happens to liars or what happens to people who oppress oppress the poor, or even people who don't pay attention in church. And there are these really detailed, painful torments that happen to you, even if you're just not paying attention in church.
They are unbelievably detailed. Can you paint a picture of some of that which inspired so much fear within people?
Yeah, so the punishment for adultery or for premarital relations for women was to be strung up by your hair, held by your hair, and then sort of submerged in sort of this filthy, mucky mire, they call it. For some of the other punishments, you would have rocks thrown at you by angels, or you'd be immersed in flames of fire up to your neck. For women who had expose their infants, they would be submerged, and then their infants would shoot bolts of lightning at them out of their eyes, which is just a terrifying image to even just contemplate. And then there are other regions of sort of big pits where people are thrown into and sort of hooks that are used to suspend people. It's pretty detailed and gruesome.
And they became much more specific as Christianity began gathering steam. What's the relationship there, do you think?
Yeah, as Christianity starts to think more and more about how do we get people to be good, they start to devise more specific tortures. One of the reasons for this is just the technology of torture was developing during the period. One of the other reasons was that the tortures correlate to the sin. So the reason why women are suspended by their hair is because hair was sort of a thing of beauty in the ancient world, and women's hair was sort of very seductive. So it would be the thing that had allowed you to sin, your beautiful hair, was now being used to punish you. So there's sort of a correlation between the sin and the punishment in that way. And one of the reasons for that was just to instruct people. Today, when we think about how do you teach your children to be good, we no longer use physical punishment. We try not to threaten them. But in the ancient world, they thought that this was how you school your children. You would beat them and you would scare them. And so these stories are about scaring people. And even though it doesn't mean a lot to us because it seems so barbaric, it was a way of getting people to behave correctly.
Mm-hmm. So it becomes this tool for behavior. And we see that in Europe, you know, the images of the damned over the lintels of these early Christian and medieval churches. But that notion of the cruel, judgmental Old Testament God that would send you to the fiery furnace, how does that work today when a more loving Christian theology dominates and is much more popular?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's and that sort of idea of could you really punish someone forever and ever? How could that be ethical? That's one of the reasons that many modern theologians now disavow hell entirely. And if they do believe in hell, they talk about hell as a place where God isn't present. So you're cut off from God's presence, and that's going to be punishment enough. There's going to be, you know, fire or tortures or devils hurting you. For some people, even that is too difficult. They think, well, could a just God really do that? But there are still certain branches of Christianity that feel very strongly that hell does exist, and that if you deny hell, not only are you going there yourself, but you could lead other people there too.
How so?
Well, so for example, the very famous pastor Rob Bell, who has a TV show now, he was disavowed by other evangelicals for saying, look, I just can't get on board with hell. It just doesn't seem good to me. And a lot of people sort of expelled him from their communities and pushed him out. Things have turned out all right for Rob Bell, but the reason they did that was they thought, well, if he tells people there isn't a hell, then they're not going to believe in something really important. And if there is a hell, it's important that people know because they'll behave correctly in order to avoid it. So the idea is if you deny hell and teach other people not to believe in hell, perhaps they'll start just doing whatever they want.
We're talking about evolving notions of hell with Dr. Candida Moss. She's a professor of theology at Notre Dame University who specializes in the study of martyrdom in the early Christian church. Some contemporary Christians even say that the traditional visions of hell have suppressed the truth of the all-loving God. Are they opposing images of hell and God?
Yeah, this is one of the questions. How could you have an all-loving God who could possibly allow something like hell to continue to exist? Some people have said, well, it's about justice. If you sin against God, you deserve to be punished. And in the historical context in which that idea emerged, that made sense because it was the medieval period and they were very acutely focused on justice and punishment like this. There is a tension here, an undeniable tension between an all-loving deity and eternal punishment. And I think one way to get around this is to look at what's the purpose of hell? When people dreamed this up, what were they using it for? And they were using it for instruction. Now, it doesn't really serve that purpose in the modern world because this isn't how we teach people anymore. So I think it is worth saying, if this isn't a good tool for instructing people, should we really have it? Should we really talk about it, especially when it's at odds with the idea of a loving deity?
I also would imagine that the demise of this concept of hell or the erosion of this concept of hell happens while the state is rising. The state is policing you. The state is making sure that you behave.
Yeah, to an extent, although often before the modern period, the state would also harness this idea of hell in order to punish people. So when heretics were burned under the auspices of the church, but also by political regimes in early modern Europe, they would say, well, burning you at the stake now in the hopes that you avoid the torments of the flames of hell. So we're doing you a favor by setting you on fire now.
You mentioned the outlier theologians, some of whom embraced a more loving vision of God, less of hell as a place. How do you think it's evolving in our all-over culture, this notion or concept of hell?
Well, I think today, because people have a different sort of understanding of geology, people don't think of hell as a space that's down, that's very hot, that you go to when you die underneath the ground. So I think that's fallen away. And I think now when people look around the world, they see enough injustice and violence and horror in our modern world that hell is now more something that we can see around us that affects people's lives that we could potentially try and change. So I think just in the sort of metaphorical vocabulary of hell, hell is now being applied to situations of injustice, and this is probably a good thing, people are trying to fix that.
Dr. Candida Moss, professor of theology at Notre Dame, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You can read Candida Moss's full article on the purpose of hell at wordofmouthradio.org.
Hit it! Cue hell! Cue hell!
In the 14th century, the Black Death claimed the lives of more than 20 million people in Europe. In 1918, the Spanish flu killed upwards of 50 million worldwide and nearly 700,000 people in the U.S. Stay with us for a conversation on how history's worst epidemics changed how we treat and bury our dead. That's after a short break when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. At the height of the Ebola epidemic in West Africa last fall, the community's hardest hit struggled not only to contain the outbreak, but also how to honor their burial traditions as the casualties mounted. Providing a dignified burial in the midst of mass epidemics is something that people have struggled with throughout history. Simon Davis writes the post-mortem column for Vice and joined us to talk about how history's worst epidemics changed the way we treat and bury the dead. He began in 14th century London at the height of the Black Death. I asked him how many Londoners fell victim to the plague.
Well, estimates are that it killed between one-third and one-half of London's residents, which historians have placed between 40 and 100,000 at the time.
Wow. So when it came to dealing with the dead, how did they make space to bury them?
Once the plague hit, there was basically a mad dash to actually build cemeteries. These were done at the outskirts of the city. Land had to be purchased. The church took the lead in that. And this was really driven just by logistics. There was no space. In the immediate aftermath, I mean, one result, there were two main things that happened in people's perception. One was that people seeing how the church just didn't know how to cope with this, right? The church authority was undermined, and this was just due to a lack of manpower and not really knowing what to do. But at a philosophical level, death changed from this kind of inevitable but somewhat predictable part of life to, in many ways, an evil villain.
Well, let's move to an epidemic more recent and closer to home, the influenza epidemic of 1918. Now, this was also called the Spanish flu. Numbers pretty shocking. How many people killed in that epidemic?
The worldwide toll, it's anywhere between 30 and 50 million, which is actually more than World War I, which most people don't know. In the U.S., nearly 700,000, 675,000. And the population of the U.S. at the time was about a third of what it is today.
It's just staggering. Why don't we hear about this more often, do you think?
You know, I doubt there's one answer to that question. You know, 1918 was a pretty pivotal year. The best one that I found myself, and, you know, it's certain to be a confluence of factors, is the Alfred Crosby quote that circulates out there. And his quote is that the very nature of the disease and its epidemiological characteristics encourage forgetfulness in the societies it affected. The disease moved too fast, arrived, flourished, and was gone before many people had time to fully realize just how great was the danger.
So just devastating in its speed and its destruction. How did that death toll affect daily life in the U.S.?
Well, mainly freedom of movement, but also general chaos. So public gatherings were severely restricted. Officials really didn't have good plans in place to tackle the epidemic, and the media failed to inform the citizenry of the real threats.
Was the media just too slow to catch up?
No, it was a lot of it had to do with just keeping people's morale at a certain level. I mean, again, keep in mind, 1918, this is time of World War I, Espionage Act. They were really conflicted about telling people what was really going on, and the result is that they weren't telling people the truth, basically.
So it was deliberate. How about public life in the United States? At that time, they were much more aware of germs and how they could be transmitted. How did it affect how people dealt with each other?
Again, the prohibitions on public gatherings were the biggest stressor. I mean, funerals are a part of that, of course. And certainly with a death toll like that, it was an important part. But, you know, just being out in groups of more than a certain amount was forbidden. If somebody had a dead body, they couldn't really do anything with it but keep it in the house, and it would be left there to rot. Mm. Death is stressful enough even under, you know, sort of normal conditions, right? So you can imagine that in these situations, these logistical and other challenges, I mean, it was just horrifying for people.
Well, and you write about some of the hysteria that overtook people. People buried into mass graves, funeral parlors, price gouging, municipalities struggling to get people buried.
Nobody had ever dealt with this in peacetime at home on such a mass scale. So there was just the confusion and the horror took over. And, you know, one tidbit is that people reported bodies turning black. And so people actually started to talk about the Black Death. It was very easy for people to make that analogy, which only made it more scary.
Well, a proper burial, now this is an essential part of maintaining social fabric. We place a very high value on it. Well, of course, we've heard about this most recently when it comes to the diminishing, though ongoing, Ebola epidemic in West Africa. Mm-hmm. First, what is considered to be a decent burial in West Africa?
So keeping in mind that I'm not an anthropologist, so I don't want to speak to the cultural perception aspect. However, from a logistical point of view, Christianity and Islam are the main religions in West Africa. And so a Christian burial there has a lot of similarities with a Christian burial in the U.S., say, in the 1800s. So the families would take the lead in washing, preparing the dead, and a cemetery burial to follow. Cremation isn't culturally accepted. Touching and kissing of the body by family is a customary part of the mourning process, which, of course, for most ailments, is certainly not a health hazard. However, Ebola is not most ailments.
Right, true. Ebola can actually be spread from the dead to the living. So was it possible to even have a proper burial at the height of the Ebola epidemic?
As soon as the outbreak began and there began to be international assistance for the countries afflicted, because obviously this was something that their local governments is just way beyond the scope of what they could handle, organizations on the ground basically used World Health Organization protocol for natural disasters. The primary directive was removal, and this was done to assure the immediate safety of the living. That was really the priority here. So as you can imagine, it was very jarring for the local population to see crews in hazmat suits taking away their loved ones from a house to never really see them ever again. Mm. Among other things, this also led people to not want to cooperate with the crews. And so when people wouldn't tell, that wouldn't report, I think they had, for example, over there in Sierra Leone, they have a 3-digit number you can call if you have, it's called the Ebola hotline, basically. So if you have someone that dies in your house and you suspect that it might be Ebola, you're supposed to call there and just not touch anything. So a lot of people just wouldn't do that, and they would do what they did before and basically try to have a burial on the down low, mm-hmm. if you will.
Will West African societies return to pre-Ebola burial customs, do you think?
I think so. After the initial sort of hubbub and the challenges that they had, they came up with, a protocol that actually was called safe and dignified burials. And they really emphasized safe, dignified, and medical, just to make sure that this was done in a manner that could be seen as culturally sensitive. Mm-hmm. And so I think with that, there was an understanding among the population that, hey, these people are coming here to help. They're doing the best they can, but at the same time, safety first. So I think that, and with transmissions, hopefully at some point, going down to zero, I think that it will go back to what it was before.
Simon Davis, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Simon Davis, a Washington, D.C.-based writer. He writes about death and other morbid things for Vice USA in a weekly column. It's called Postmortem. Death is a family affair, especially when it's also the family business. This next story about an unusual mother-daughter relationship comes to us from the podcast Criminal.
There was a gentleman who had been living there for quite some time and had been without heat since the previous November, and that was actually around the last time that he'd been seen alive.
This is Kathleen Vernon. She's the coroner for Albany County in southeastern Wyoming. In 2012, she was called to a small cabin out on the prairie, not far from Laramie, where she lives.
And one of his family members had finally called in to the sheriff's department to go check on him. And they had found that he was no longer living.
It was January, and 32 degrees inside the cabin. What they found was basically a mummified body. When Kathleen got the body back to the lab and began the autopsy, things got even more bizarre. It looked like the man had been getting hypothermia and then somehow surviving it over and over again, which seemed crazy, like something out of a movie, until Kathleen remembered seeing something unusual in his house.
In the refrigerator of his home, there had been a bottle of antifreeze next to a drinking glass. It's kind of a weird place to keep antifreeze. I don't generally keep things like that in the fridge. And as it turned out, he had ethylene glycol crystals in his kidneys, which is what happens when you consume antifreeze. The active ingredient is ethylene glycol. So the theory that we came up with was that he had been intentionally consuming antifreeze to keep himself from freezing, from dying of hypothermia, and that for at least a while it had probably worked.
What did you do when you figured this out?
So I called my mom.
I'm Phoebe Judge. This is Criminal.
Kathleen, do you remember the call when you said, "I'm going to call my mom," and the police officers around you laughed, and one of them said,
"Yeah,
you don't know her mom."
Yeah, one of the officers was like, "Oh, well, it makes sense. Her mom's an investigator too."
It was also 3 o'clock in the morning.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's when this happens.
There are only 3 female coroners in the entire state of Wyoming. Kathleen Vernon, or Casey, as her family calls her, is one of them. She's 25 years old and has been working with a coroner's office since she was 21, her first job out of college, which, it goes without saying, isn't exactly something you learn about at a career fair. So you can't help but wonder, how did she get to this point?
We perhaps exposed Kathleen to life situations that 99% of people never see or hear about.
This is Linda Vernon, Kathleen's mom. Linda spent decades as a homicide investigator and coroner in California. Kathleen's father, Bill, is an investigator for the state of Wyoming. Growing up in Cheyenne, the Vernon family surrounded themselves with other people in law enforcement. It's a pretty small town. And when the Vernons had a party, most of the talk was about cases people were working on, bad guys they had just caught. So when Kathleen started showing an interest in death, something that would scare a lot of parents, the Vernons took it in stride. Like one time when Kathleen was about 4 years old and found a dead gopher in the backyard. She spent a weekend crouched over its body, watching flesh-eating beetles take it apart.
I've always really liked bugs. Like, I really like bugs. And I think they were red or orange and just the coolest things I'd ever seen.
And then, when she was 11, Kathleen took it a step further and began raising beetles for a science fair project. Linda was all for it.
You know, in museums, they usually have tanks of beetles that they can debride flesh from bones with and end up with perfect specimens for display or study. And she said, I want to do that. So I called the Museum of Natural History in Denver and got a hold of the curator. And he kindly sent her a box of beetles from his tank. And so for many weeks, we had a 20-gallon aquarium in our living room full of bugs and dead things.
And you would you all just sit around watching it kind of on the couch like it was a television?
No. but she had to keep track of what they were doing and watch very carefully, because one of the specimens that she put in there was a bird, and they have very tiny bones, and these bugs will completely consume the tiny bones on a small specimen like that. And we also did not kill anything for her to do this. A bird flew into our living room window as happenstance, karmic happenstance, I think. And so she collected that and put it in there first. And then we contacted a local taxidermist, and he was kind enough to give us a skull. I believe it was a fox skull, Casey?
It was a fox.
And then we tried, that Thanksgiving, we tried a turkey neck. But it was cooked, and the beetles apparently don't care for their specimens to be cooked. They didn't do as good a job on that as they did on her other things.
After the science project ended, Kathleen, 11 years old, made a special box to preserve that little bird carcass. And even today, the bird skeleton lies in its box in her mother's sewing room. When Linda gave birth to Kathleen, she stopped working as a homicide investigator and coroner. But she couldn't actually give up the work she loved so much. So she began writing for police trade publications like Police Magazine and Police Chief Magazine. Once, Linda was writing about blood spatter and recreated a crime scene in the house with real blood, her own blood.
I went to visit our family doctor. I explained what I was doing and asked him if he would draw a vial of my blood for me to use, because I certainly wouldn't have wanted to use an unknown specimen of blood, for example. And you get best results with the real thing. So my blood was the most, the best way to do this. So he drew me a vial of blood, and I set up a crime scene in the back hall of our house and did the blood spatters and one-to-one photographs while Casey was gone from home. And when she came home, I think everything was pretty much gone.
And what did you say to her what did you say to Kathleen when she was a little kid? How did you explain to her that there are people who do bad things sometimes and they can result in terrible injury or in death?
Pretty much exactly that way. My husband and I both strongly believe that if a child is intelligent enough to formulate a question, they deserve a truthful answer. And that is what she always got. Life is often not very pretty, but by the same token, it is often extraordinarily beautiful. And we tried to impart both those things to her.
Eventually, Kathleen moved out. She went to college. But unlike a lot of kids, Kathleen didn't leave her childhood interests at home. When she was in school, she called up the county coroner and told them she wasn't afraid of gruesome things. She said, "I'm not afraid of death, and I'd like to go out on a call with you."
I had just turned 21. It was like 6 days after my 21st birthday. And he called me. I was at a concert in town. He said, "You know, we have a call. Do you want to go? And of course, I think I knocked my chair over getting up to leave.
That night, she saw her first dead body. The coroner gave her a camera and told her to take photographs of the scene. It was a man who died of a stomach bleed.
And I thought it was just the most fascinating thing I'd ever seen, because I realized that you could piece together what this person's life had been like from the things that were in his house, from, you know, his life in a holistic sense, what day-to-day life was like, down to what was that last night like.
After that first body, she was hooked. Now she works for the county. The coroner is an elected position, and she's serving her first term, about to run for re-election. Kathleen says she gets about 80 bodies a year. But the weird thing is that the work isn't steady. She'll have multiple bodies in the same day, and then nothing for a month.
It turns out that people die in groups. And I know that there are smarter people than I who've tried to figure out why this happens. I think the old wives' tale is that it's the moon. And there may be some truth to that, or it could be complete hocus pocus. You know, maybe it's the barometric pressure or the tides or who knows what. But there seems to be some sort of grouping that happens.
She says a lot of people in her field don't talk about their work with outsiders. It's just too sad, too morbid and depressing. So Kathleen feels lucky she can turn to her mother for support. And while Linda's tough, there have been cases that even she can't shake off.
One in particular was the only child of a farm labor family, and the father was gone. It was Christmas morning. The baby was 3 months old, and it was probably the hardest day to have to be there with that woman until I could find someone who could come and be an advocate for her. That was a very tough day. I was directly involved in the investigation of the homicide of two FBI agents, and I remember that day very vividly. I was on scene when two El Centro police officers were murdered in the line of duty. I remember that day. But you keep those things, like I explained to Casey, you keep those things in little boxes, and you shove them down as far as you can, and every once in a while you take them out and look. And I think it keeps you honest.
Kathleen, your husband is also a coroner, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so basically everyone you're surrounded by is in some way involved with law enforcement or death. I wonder, what do you talk about at Thanksgiving?
If I can interject.
Yeah,
Casey,
please.
Came home when she was a teenager and looked at me after having spent a weekend with a friend, I think, and said, "Mom, do you have any idea how profoundly different our dinner table conversation is than anyone else's?" It's an abiding thing. I mean, it's something we've talked about all of her life, and the cycle continues, apparently.
So much of what you do as a parent has an effect on your kid. And when so much of the family is in the business of death, well, your kid becomes a coroner and then gets married to another coroner. It's a little unclear how Kathleen feels about being so exposed to crime and death as a kid.
You know, I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with the way that I was raised or with how I turned out. I mean, I have a career. I'm, you know, relatively well adjusted for a person of my age and so forth. Whatever you do when you're a parent is going to have some kind of impact on your child. And at some point in that child's life, they're probably going to think that the impact is negative. All you can do is do the best you can.
So the big question now is, how much will Kathleen expose her own child? And it's not hypothetical. She's 8.5 months pregnant. She's due next week.
And that piece came to us from the podcast Criminal and was produced by Phoebe Judge, Eric Manel, and Lawrence Borer. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
With help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.